Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guests tonight are Kent Russell, CEO of the Museum of Russian Icons in Clinton, and Nick Capasso, director of the Fitchburg Art Museum in Fitchburg. We talked to both of them about a month ago about how their museums were doing because of the COVID shutdowns, and we're going to continue our conversation tonight. Welcome back, both of you. When last we spoke, both of your museums were still closed to the public. I'm going to ask you one at a time, what is the status of your museums now? Kent, you go first.
Well, we're open, but we're open limited hours and limited days. We're open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and that's it. We used to be open 6 days a week, but now we can cope with three.
Now, let me ask you honestly, why? Is that just because of a shortage of personnel?
Yes. It's the overhead costs of reopening are pretty much double our cost. And so if we have the time, we're hoping that the audience will telescope into a shorter period of time. That's the ideal outcome of this. And we keep our overheads cleaning, extra staff that's required to ensure the compliance of the COVID requirements.
Is there any concern, Kent, that by doing that, now you're going to get the galleries too crowded?
Yes.
Okay.
And so that's why we need some extra staff. And online booking, and we have four slots a day.
So you have online booking. That was, the piece I wasn't picking up on.
Yeah.
Okay. Nick, how are you doing?
We reopened on July 22nd.
Okay.
We've opened for our regular hours 5 days a week. In the two full weeks that we've been open, we've had 162 visitors.
Oh, wow.
Which really surprised me. And they seem very happy to be back. They're also behaving themselves.
Well, that's going to be one of my next questions, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay.
We've had to remind a couple of people, but everyone's been pretty gracious about the whole thing.
Well, let me talk to both of you, and again, answer in turn. Obviously, this is going to require retraining staff to deal with different kinds of situations, correct?
Right.
What did you have to teach your staff to do?
Well, we have a 14-page protocol,
and
we've had innumerable staff meetings. We have to teach everybody masks, distancing, the traffic flow in the building, how to approach visitors who might not be complying, how to ask people to wait outside until their time is ready. It's a lot of finickety detail, which, you never intended to have to do.
Nick, what about you? Go ahead.
It's very similar. We thankfully received some specific guidelines for museums as part of Governor Baker's Phase 3 reopening plans. And it's been very important to us to be, complete Boy Scouts here. follow it to the letter. And as Kent said, there's a lot of persnickety details. Things are just done differently. And, part of that is that our security team is now also our hygiene team. There's cleaning going on all day long.
Oh, wow. What change required the greatest effort or the greatest sort of rethink from both of you, Kent?
That's a huge question. I mean, this is just such a tsunami of catastrophe.
That's a catastrophe of catastrophes, right?
Everything's affected. Our membership is affected. Our annual appeals are affected. Our public a personality, the way we intersect with our community, the way we contribute to the local restaurants because we're an attraction. And, you know,
right, right.
It just goes on and on and on. You know, it's no wonder that the United States economy has fell by 33%. I mean, we feel it here. Our audience are down by 2/3, and the related income that should have been coming in from admissions, store sales, cafe, all that kind of stuff, are enormously diminished.
Nick, for you, the greatest effort is what? Is it just getting everybody to be COVID aware?
I think so. Also, we had to do a lot of rearranging of things in the galleries.
Huh.
At the Fitchburg Art Museum, you know, pre-virus, we had a lot of hands-on activities for kids and families.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And that has all had to be put away or walled off or taped off with signage. We went through great lengths to be, to offer this kind of interactivity, and now we have to go back to being an old-fashioned museum where all you can do is walk in and look at stuff.
I know. So it's really crushing to watch this happen to museums because, I mean, there really was in the last several decades a big effort to have interactive aspects of your collection with the public, and it's now like you're being saying, never mind.
No. Right. Well, and the other challenge, too, at least in Fitchburg, we show a lot of contemporary art. And a lot of contemporary art is designed to be interactive.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When we reopened with our After Spiritualism show, we had to negotiate with a lot of the artists about, you know, which aspects of their work needed to be closed down and how we were going
wow.
to... Wow. recontextualize it or present it differently, and that all worked out, but it's not something anyone had thought we'd ever have to do.
Ken, when I think about the Museum of Russian Icons collection, I'm thinking of objects that people have a very personal relationship with. Not everybody that comes to the museum, but certainly a percentage of the people. Is that going to be affected by new regulations?
Well, I think in our case at the Museum of Russian Icons, when you do get here and you do make your reservation and you arrive,
right.
It's a very intimate experience because we limit to 20 people.
So, and in one sense, it may actually be a better personal experience for the audience.
Yes, it might be, except for those with who might need our audio guide, which we can't give out, or any handheld, like additional information, which we might put on a table, books and stuff like that. That's all gone. But the actual encounter with the object is actually a pretty good experience.
Right,
because
right.
It's very quiet and very intimate. Yeah.
Now, this may be a dumb question, but it's one that bothers me a lot because I see so many examples of this on the web. How are you two institutions dealing with public who refuse to wear masks? Because there's some crazy-ass people out there.
Yeah. We've been very fortunate so far. We have not had any mask refusal. We've had to remind a few folks, but as I said earlier, they were gracious and put their masks back on.
But what what's your
what's our policy?
Yeah,
if someone refuses. Well, the policy is that our security people tell them that they're free to exercise whatever rights they think they have off of our campus.
Okay.
And if they're unhappy about that, we give them a free pass to come back at a time when they see it, that, they won't have to wear a mask in the museum.
Oh, okay.
If they're still unhappy with that, security is directed to go up the chain of command to me.
Whoa.
I will be happy to have a conversation.
So you're going to be the bouncer that essentially gets, because I've seen some.
Yeah.
Extreme reactions where people just essentially have a meltdown.
And well, people start having a meltdown, we're calling the police.
Okay. All right.
And not because we're not calling the police because someone is refusing to wear a mask. We're calling the police because someone is making a scene,
right,
threatening our visitors and staff and refusing to leave the premises.
In that sense, it's the same as it pre-COVID. Like if you had a person right. acting like that in your galleries, you'd be doing the exact same thing.
That's exactly right.
Ken, what about you? Is it essentially the same?
It's essentially the same.
Are you the ultimate bouncer in the museum?
Absolutely. Our instructions are very clear. Is that the staff are not to engage with a problematic visitor.
Interesting.
Call me right away, and I'll deal with it. So there's not exactly a chain of command that I would get on the phone right away if I'm off campus. And I would come back and deal with it face to face. But there are no masks, no entry. It's clearly stated in the pre-booking materials online, and it's discussed on the phone with visitors who are making a booking via phone. And as I say, we haven't had any difficulty at all, nor have we had much lack of compliance within the building.
Good.
We have signs throughout which says, you know, continue to wear your mask.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, Kent, but in my discussions with other museum directors in museums that have opened, no one has reported any mask refusal yet.
I almost feel like maybe we shouldn't be talking about this. Because yeah. you just know the tenor of the times is such that as soon as you do that, a certain group of people are going to make a point of causing you grief. So let's move on.
You might jinx it.
That's exactly. Right. And I just want to warn everybody who's thinking about that. Both of these directors are small, but they're wiry. So now, this may be a tough question. What lessons have you learned so far? Like, what have you learned looking down the future that you now go, okay, I'm going to do this differently? Let me give you a couple. Let me think about that. Let me cogitate on that while I ask another concern I have. Looking at the state of the entire country, I am very nervous that we're going to be reshutting stuff down in fall because there's just the southern states aren't doing anything. And Massachusetts has still got quite a number of cases. Nothing like what's going on in Florida and Texas and California. But are you prepared to have to go through this whole rigmarole again? Are you better prepared now?
Well, we're certainly better prepared because we've already shut down once, and we were all prepared for opening up. So we're prepared for cycles of opening and closure, and we anticipated that. You know, it's just part of the uncertainty. And now, with kids going back to school in certain proportions across the country, I really feel that within 6 weeks of that, most of the country will be shut down again because this is not rocket science. The epidemiologists have been right all along, and it's just numbers and probability, and you can't argue with that stuff. Although, you know, our politicians try to.
Well, you know, even here in Massachusetts, and I'm very keenly aware about mask wearing and social distancing, I'm starting to see increased numbers of people just not wearing masks and gathering together in groups. I just saw an enormous party this weekend in Spencer. Must have had 70 people at it in a small backyard. Not a single person was wearing a mask. And, you know, you almost felt like pulling over and going, what the hell? It's like you want to ruin it for everybody else. But, you know, I think that's the reality that we're going to be facing another shutdown.
Yeah, I do too.
Kent, what about you?
Well, of course, you just reverse engineer. You keep on opening and closing, opening and closing.
So is that I think that's one of the advantages of a mid-sized museum, like both of yours are medium-sized museums, is that you can turn on a dime. I've always had that impression about both your museums. Is that true or not?
That, that's true partially, but it doesn't address the staffing issues. How long can you bring staff on part-time? And I know both of us at the Fitchburg Art Museum and the Museum of Russian Icons use part-time staff for front desk and things like that.
Right.
Guards.
Right.
How do you deal with that? The financial stress on the institution to close for, let's say, a three-month period and continue to pay these people so that they remain a part of your team when you reopen. That's the pending financial catastrophe that all museums are talking about, but that we can't plan for because we don't know.
Right, and the larger the museum, the more difficult this
is. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Geometrically.
Right.
You know, it's just, and the larger
museums.
They're
not reopening.
Right, they're not opening. And they also have horrible income problems because they rely on admissions and parking and food service and
gift
shop in a way that we don't.
Right, that's correct. I mean, we have a certain elasticity because the smaller institutions, well, in our case, at any rate, we don't rely for the majority of our income on earned income, on admissions, on tours, things like that. The bigger institutions do. And so you see places like the Worcester Art Museum, the MFA in Boston, the Ecotarium, thinking locally, not opening until the fall because this wear and tear of opening and reclosing and it is just too difficult to manage.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I don't want to use this as an analogy, but the sports thing seems to be sort of a metaphor. What's going on for a lot of businesses like this is there was this huge push to open, open, open. And even though they put in all sorts of restrictions, no sooner did they start to open, they were already starting to see, for instance, in baseball, the virus doesn't care. And
no, the virus doesn't care, and a lot of the players aren't bathing themselves.
Yeah, I know.
You know?
But I mean, there's that sense like, okay, we're going to have a season. Well, and it'll be a modified season, but we'll have a season. But now, you know, so these large institutions, like baseball, like sports, like the larger museums, I think are facing greater problems, although you two, both of you are facing serious, grave problems. I think the amount, the level of the problems in these large institutions is grim indeed.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Is there any talk about museums shutting permanently?
I haven't had any of my colleagues talk about that.
And I'm not talking about either of your institutions. I have faith in you guys hanging in there.
We're not shutting.
I knew that.
And I haven't spoken to anyone personally, but there have been reports, Mass Cultural Council, American Alliance of Museums, that suggest that we might be looking at a wave of museum closures.
Really?
But, you know, as Kent said, I haven't heard this directly from anyone yet. Of course, this isn't something that people talk about.
No, I know. And I think it's maybe just enough to mention the fact that that's on some people's radar, and that's it. I mean, I worry about places like Sturbridge Village.
If this goes on for 2 years, I don't, you know, that's a whole nother thing.
Well, but you know, is everybody waiting for a vaccine? Is that essentially what's happening? Is like, at this point,
right,
we can't rely on society doing the right thing because it's just not happening.
It's not happening.
And so is it essentially, okay, get moving with the vaccine.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, everyone's great hope to fix the situation is get a vaccine. But that, you know, it's still not determined. When that's going to be available.
It's probably going to be it's going to be next year.
Yeah. And when are they going to be able to ramp up production? And how safe is it going to be? And kind of anti-vaxxer nonsense are we going to, you know, be dealing with?
This is like some kind of weird thing you read in a dystopian fiction piece. And like we're living it, and it's surreal to be having to talk to both of you, who I've known for so long, in this vein because it's just bizarre. awful and bizarre. Even if, okay, say all things are fine, like a vaccine comes up in January or February and most people get vaccinated, will things ever be as they were in 2019? Kent, you want to answer that?
Well, you know, there's a breakdown in trust among us as Americans.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there are some institutions that are now very severely damaged their reputation. CDC, a lot of conservatives are very concerned about different forms of government. More liberal are worried about the police forces. But you know what? I think museums can take this as an opportunity to position themselves as places that are neutral, that people can come in and have difficult conversations, at least with themselves and works of art that they see on our walls. Maybe there's some good in this.
The museum is a safe space.
Yeah.
I can see that. I can see that. Nick, you want to address that?
Yeah, I think one of the big changes we're going to see, and this goes to the, you know, the country's change in the wake of George Floyd's killing, is that the philanthropic sector has been kind of gently encouraging nonprofits and museums to be more diverse,
right,
to be more connected with their local communities, to adequately represent the people in their local communities on their staff and on their boards. And I think they're going to run out of patience. I think they're going to take the urgency of this moment and basically start telling nonprofits that if your board is all white or all male or both, you're not getting any funding anymore. Because a lot of these large philanthropic organizations like the Ford Foundation or the Barr Foundation or the Pew Charitable Trust, their mission is to affect social change. And I think they're at the point where they're going to really start affecting social change. And I think that's going to be a real eye-opener for nonprofits.
Has there ever been a time like this for museums in, say, the last century, where that kind of thing, where social change is going to fuel how museums, how museums are staffed and what museums show? I don't think there has been.
I think in the wake of the civil rights movements, there were,
I think you're right,
new museums opened to address people who have been underrepresented in museums. So you've got the Smithsonian Museums of African American History and Native American History, which didn't exist before the civil rights movement. Nothing I think is sweeping as what's going on now.
I think Kent was onto something, though. I think this whole thing has just shaken everybody's confidence in everything.
It certainly exposed the weaknesses in everything.
Yeah, you're right. And our social fabric, too, especially how we deal with things like illness.
Yeah. Although it's interesting, you know, when you look back at the last big pandemic, the flu in 1918, 1919, one of the interesting things about that is that when that ended and we were no longer under threat of the flu, people did their very best in their behavior and their history writing and in their, you know, daily lives to pretend it never happened. They just got on with it.
Forgotten
pandemic. Nobody wanted to dwell on it, and I'm wondering if we might see something like that here. I don't know.
Like what me pandemic?
Yeah, like or just this huge enthusiasm to get back to life as normal and put the whole thing behind us.
But is there ever going to be? I mean, is there going to be a return to, like, say, the, you know, 2018, 2019 normal? Or is it just going to be there's a new normal that everybody's going to get used to?
I think there's going to be a new normal, because look at what happened to travel. For those of us who traveled before 9/11, and the experience of traveling now is completely different.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
And so we tolerate long lines going through innumerable different checks and security checkpoints, and we add an extra hour for all of that to our lives. I think that's where we're going to be.
Nick, you want to say anything about that?
Well, I'm hoping Kent's certainly right about travel. I'm hoping that the big changes will be political.
Right.
I'm hoping that the sheer inability of the federal executive to deal with any of this.
Oh, it's been shameful. It's been shameful.
We look
awful by the rest of the world. It's interesting because I interview people all over the world, and after the interview ends, I always get a barrage of questions like, "What the hell is going on in your country?" and as if I could like answer on behalf of the entire country, but I'll tell you, I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed that I interview scientists, artists, and historians all around the world, and I'm barraged by, what the hell is wrong with your country? And it is a serious question. I mean, and I had gotten that before during the Bush 2 administration. I'd started to pick up on a lot of that.
Yeah.
But now I'm getting very serious, very grim things that people just think, we're essentially a bunch of know-nothing barbarians that they don't want to have anything to do with.
Yeah, we've certainly lost our way.
We really have, and it's going to take it to come back. One more question before we have to hang up. Have museums been sharing resources, tips, and plans like with each other to help each other out?
Yes.
Good. That's nice.
Certainly in my case, we have.
So you get, is there some sort of thing where people are getting together and Zooming and going like, how are you dealing with this?
Yeah.
Do you know that I've yet to do a Zoom, by the way, you guys? I'm literally religiously avoiding a Zoom. I am a Zoom virgin.
Right.
I want to get through this and not having Zoomed.
No, it's a syndrome. You can Zoom for 20 minutes and concentrate. After that, you're a vegetable.
So, Nick, what's your Zoom limit? Is it 20 minutes? 20 minutes seems like about a lot. And how many people can be on the Zoom before it just gets ridiculous?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that. If there are more people on the call than you can see on your screen.
it's too many.
Pretty much lost it.
Well, we're going to check back in with you again in probably another month and a half, because I want to keep this going and find out how you guys are doing and where we are. God knows, I have no idea where we're going to be in a month and a half. My returning guests tonight are Kent Russell, CEO of the Museum of Russian Icons here in Clinton, and Nick Apasso, director of the Fitchburg Art Museum in Fitchburg. Both of you, thank you so much. But I really am interested in keeping this conversation going, so we'll talk again.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Be well.
Thank you, Mark.
Oh, yeah. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.